Hello there, and a very warm welcome to episode 38 of the Asia Climate Finance Podcast. Decarbonization efforts start with the commitment by government. Once the broad policy is set, the real hard work of regulation begins. To understand and advance sustainable finance, it is absolutely imperative to understand this work. In this episode, our guest is Eugene Wong, who shares his unique insights on the Southeast Asian experience. Eugene is the Chief Executive Officer of the Sustainable Finance Institute Asia. The Institute is a neutral convening platform to bring together different stakeholders to advance the sustainability agenda in ASEAN. The actors include policymakers, regulators, industry, academia, and others, and are all focused on Southeast Asia's financial sector as a catalyst for ASEAN's sustainability agenda. Today, for example, the Institute is a host to the ASEAN Taxonomy Board, collaborating with all of the capital markets regulators in Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoy the discussion, and please do support the podcast by subscribing and liking it. Hello and welcome to episode 38 again of the Asia Climate Finance Podcast. So as I've introduced Eugene, I would like to offer my greetings to him. Hello, Eugene. I know that you've been traveling. You're not 100%. So I hope you can make it through these few questions.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Joseph. It's a delight to be here.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I've introduced you a little bit, and also we have your bio on the show notes. But could you give us a little bit of an introduction, your background, you know, in your own words, please?
Well, I started life as a chartered accountant. I spent 7 years studying and working in Australia, and then subsequently I became an investment banker. And for 10 and a half years, I was a capital market regulator with the Securities Commission Malaysia. I have to say, I never thought that I would end up doing sustainable finance work.
And I think it's a very important contribution, Eugene, given your, you know, rich background. And we'll talk a little bit about, you know, the education and experience side of things in a bit. But before we get there, could you explain a little bit how exactly you got involved in the business and investments area of climate finance?
Well, maybe it might be worthwhile to take a step back to see where my interest first started. And my interest actually first started when I came across a book when I was in university called The Limits to Growth. It was a book published in, I think, 1972, and using some very rudimentary computers by our standards today for modeling. But basically what it said was that because of all the interlocking and interdependent conditions of our world, our global ecosystem would not be able to support the rates of growth, both economy and population, much more beyond 2100, which is you know, ironically the target we're looking at today as well for a lot of our climate goals. And when I was at the Securities Commission Malaysia, the university I studied at Melbourne University published a research paper reviewing the limits to growth. And it was interesting because the results of that paper essentially said the world is very much on track under the book's business as usual scenario, which meant that things weren't going all that well for us. So when I joined the Securities Commission Malaysia, and I was actually given the opportunity to work on our Southeast Asian efforts together with all my colleagues from Southeast Asia, we started thinking about how we could make the most impact using the capital markets. And naturally, I come across the Melbourne University research at that time, and it triggered me and said, I said, we need to actually use capital for good. So why don't we start thinking about how we can orient capital through the capital markets for a sustainable future? And I was very pleasantly surprised that My colleagues from the other 9 countries were also on the same page. So this is how actually in Southeast Asia, the momentum for sustainable finance in the capital market started building as well.
That's really very interesting, you know, story on how you got on, involved in climate finance. In a few words, before I start bugging you with lots of questions, other questions, could you tell us a little bit about the Sustainable Finance Institute? Because I think, you know, as we discussed, it is not an institute that I was extremely familiar with. So it'd be great to hear from you a little bit of background on the institute.
Of course. I mean, the name is a lot more glamorous than what we really are. We're actually a very small convening platform. And when I left the Securities Commission Malaysia at the end of 2019, I was contemplating going back to sell-side M&A, but particularly concentrating on the sustainable agenda. And I also had some opportunities to do consulting work on it. But then, of course, COVID came, and my idea of having 6 months off to travel and taking some time to think about what I wanted to do was scuttled, and I was stuck back home. During that time, a few things happened. The first is that my kids had watched a lot of documentaries about how the world was coming to an end in the way we know it to be. And there were a lot of concerns that because of the impact of COVID, we would actually be concentrating on other things rather than climate and sustainable growth. So I was contacted by my friends from the regulatory community, some friends from the philanthropic community, and other NGOs. And all of them ironically discussed the same thing with me. And the topic of discussion was, how can we get a neutral platform to bring the different parties with different objectives together to advance the sustainability agenda during this very difficult time? And many of them actually were quite open and asked me in a very straightforward manner, would you like to start the platform? Of course, I was half a decade old at that time and not full of energy, so I was very doubtful whether I was the right person to do it. And it's a startup. So I actually chatted with my family, and what really made me change my mind was that my kids, one of whom was 11 at that time, and the other 17, said, this is a really good idea because I think you'll be doing something which is going to be impactful and maybe useful to our generation. So I decided to start the platform. It was actually a very, very short runway for us from conception to actual launch. So we were discussing this in April 2020, and we launched by the end of June. So what we are actually here for is to be a convening platform, a totally neutral convening platform. And we bring together the official sector, being the policymakers, regulators, the governments where relevant, together with industry, academia, and CSOs. But we're very focused on two things. The first is that we can't be everything to everyone. We are designed to be small so that we can be neutral. And as a result, the first thing about us is that we are actually a platform focused on Southeast Asia, and we focus entirely on the financial sector as a catalyst for the sustainable agenda. So in that way, we're very focused in what we do. Today, we are the host of the ASEAN Taxonomy Board. We have a collaboration with the capital market regulators of Southeast Asia collectively. We work with them very closely on executing their sustainability agenda. And at the same time, we also interact with many other CSOs, think tanks, and international organizations on the Southeast Asian sustainability agenda.
That's a fantastic introduction, Eugene. And I just want to add in my own kind of simplified or idiot's guide to policy, regulation, and climate action, that, you know, the way I see it is you've got a level one kind of policy, which is the government, the individual governments saying, we're serious about climate action and this is what we're targeting. And then you've got a level two, which is really where the regulators come in, and be it, you know, the in Hong Kong, for example, be it the HKMA, the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, or the Securities Futures Commission, et cetera, et cetera. They have to put in body of regulations which will drive change, at least in the financial sector, which ultimately will impact corporations. So that's kind of like me explaining the background in the background to the background that you explained in my own kind of idiot's guide to finance regulation and climate change. So talking about that, I hope that my representation was not erroneous, Eugene.
No, I think it is true, because a lot of the national and regional directions are actually set by commitments that have been put in place, that are political commitments, actually. So the commitment to the Paris Agreement, various governments' commitments to a net zero target for themselves at the national level, and that translates down into national policies, which are executed by the policymakers and the regulators. I will also say that at times, I think the policymakers and the regulators also provide, through a very constructive feedback loop, information back to the governments for them to enhance their commitments or to amend their commitments to make sure that it's in line with the current situation.
That's great. I wanted to talk about two things, really. One is the current situation, and then the second one is some kind of outlook from you over, you know, how do you see things evolving over the next 26, 27 years from now. So on the current situation, could you tell us a little bit about the evolution of, call it climate, call it sustainable, call it transition finance, on the regulatory issues side of things, including, you know, climate risk disclosure taxonomies in Asia in general, just, you know, very, very high level snapshot of how you've seen things evolving in Asia Pacific in general. And then after that, if we could talk about ASEAN specifically. I know it's a big question to answer in 30 seconds. No, not just 30 seconds. Just kidding. But you know, just to give a little bit of background on where we're coming from.
Sure. As I mentioned just now, I think really a lot of the impetus for action comes from, firstly, the national commitments. So net zero commitments have actually driven quite a lot of national policies. And it's interesting you talked about the taxonomies and the disclosures, because these have, in a way, been the, I would say, initial thrust of the sustainable finance regulatory impact. I will later on want to talk a bit about the sustainable finance ecosystem, which of course incorporates these two elements, but has another dimension as well. But coming back to your question, I think in Asia Pacific, there's been a lot of effort. So we've been really busy down here in the Asia Pacific. And if we're not talking about ASEAN right now, I will talk about the other countries and what they've started to do, which are quite impactful. So in China, obviously, you know, Chinese government is taking this very seriously. And in September 2021, they came up with the Green Bond Endorsed Projects Catalog. Mm. And that was really impactful because it brought together a whole bunch of very fragmented guidances on this subject into one single aligned document. In 2022, they also released a guidance for enterprise ESG disclosure. Japan's actually very interesting because Japan is one country that's come up with sectoral pathways for transition. And I think this is particularly useful for Japan because they're embarking on a whole transition journey in the country and of the value chain. So you see that having this national guidance has been able to guide them, provide a roadmap. And they've also been able to issue transition bonds on the back of this particular pathways that have been created. Taxonomies in developed in Korea. In India, the business responsibility and sustainability reporting rules by SEBI were issued in 2021. I think importantly, I forgot to mention this earlier, but there was something very groundbreaking in the Asia Pacific region, and New Zealand actually was the first country in the world to introduce a law that requires climate reporting by the financial sector. I mean, it was a game changer at that time. And Australia, its neighbor, is currently in the process of implementing mandatory climate disclosures, as well as developing a taxonomy. So you can see in the Asia Pacific region, we've been really, really busy.
And how do you contrast and compare what's been happening in, you know, the rest of Asia and maybe even Europe versus Southeast Asia?
Well, I think when we talk about sustainability and sustainable finance, it's very important to understand that everybody comes from a different starting point. So we find that the developed countries may have had a head start in terms of this. And even within Asia, we have to be very careful to dissect Asia, because we have countries like China, Japan, and Korea. We have India, and we have Southeast Asia. So Southeast Asia is very different from the other countries I just mentioned. In fact, even within Southeast Asia, there are very significant differences. Because the if you just look at GDP, for example, GDPs per capita for Southeast Asian member states range from 1,300 to $72,000 per capita per annum, depending on, you know, which year you look at the comparison, but this is sort of as an average. So naturally, the progress and the approach will be different for Southeast Asia and the rest of the world. Indeed, one big challenge for Southeast Asia, who, by the way, will be the fourth largest economic bloc in 2030, one big challenge for us in Southeast Asia to move forward as this regional bloc is, how do we account for the differences in our member states, and how do we be inclusive in our approaches, yet ambitious enough? So there's been quite a bit of evolution in Southeast Asia, and I'll refer to Southeast Asia as ASEAN, because as a bloc, we're the Association of Southeast Asian Nations.
Yes, of course.
So Southeast Asia, this is happening at two levels, right? So it's both at the national level and the regional level. And the ASEAN member states are taking the agenda very, very seriously, both nationally and at a regional level as well. So just to give a very quick summary, the awareness is there, the effort is already there. Stock exchanges in 6 out of the 10 member states actually have sustainability disclosure requirements. 6 of our member states already have or are developing national taxonomies. And many of the central banks are incorporating environmental and social frameworks into their overall directive and supervision to banks. And actually, this is very important because of two reasons. The first is that you want to orient capital into the right activities and away from those that are not so desirable. The second is you also want to create a frame because it is very well acknowledged that where you can, you should actually use self-discipline. Where the market can step in, market discipline will help drive things. But where self and market discipline are not able to provide that direction and there are gaps, then the regulatory community has to step in. So I think the efforts undertaken by the ASEAN policymakers and regulators are actually extremely important, and they have been very effective. So at the ASEAN level, we are guided by three main documents on our sustainable finance journey. The first is actually a document issued by the ASEAN Capital Markets Forum. And the ASEAN Capital Markets Forum is the grouping of the 10 capital market regulators in Southeast Asia. That document is called the Roadmap for ASEAN Sustainable Capital Markets. The second document is actually issued by the ASEAN Working Committee on Capital Market Development. That committee has the capital market regulators, the central banks, and the ministries of finance in it. And they issued a report on promoting sustainable finance in ASEAN. The third report is actually by the central banks, and it's aptly titled The Roles of ASEAN Central Banks in Managing Climate and Environment-Related Risks. So if I actually look at these three documents and try and distill the elements in all three documents, really it's talking about creating an ecosystem for sustainable finance in Southeast Asia. And these efforts are actually underpinned by three pillars. So I mentioned just now early on about the ecosystem. The three pillars that these three reports are trying to build are firstly, a common language, a taxonomy. And it is well understood that a taxonomy must apply very much to the economic, social, and resource situations of the countries it is addressing. So in Southeast Asia, we've got 10 countries. If every country comes up with a national taxonomy, we will have 10 taxonomies. And I think it's perfectly fine to have 10 taxonomies for each country, because those taxonomies actually address national priorities and national agendas. So we can't have one taxonomy covering the national priorities and national agendas of every single country. But if we have 10 taxonomies, then as a bloc, you know, we'll be the fourth largest bloc in 2030. How do we get capital oriented into us as a bloc? And how do we guide our regional ambition as a bloc? So it's important for us then to have an overlay. It's important for us to have a common language and an overarching guide. And that is why we need an ASEAN taxonomy, a regional taxonomy created specifically to help ASEAN achieve its climate ambitions. The second element is actually one which is being talked a lot now. It was not something that was talked a lot when the ASEAN community was looking at it, and that is transition. So I have to mention also that the three reports I talked about just now were all endorsed in 2020, so it's kind of like a bit visionary at that time. But transition has become a very big word these days. It's absolutely dominating conversations, because everyone's starting to realize that you can't turn green overnight, and you essentially need space, time, and a pathway to become green. So this is about an evolution, because we can't have rapid revolutions. Rapid revolutions cause social and economic dislocations. So what we really want to do is to be able to transition. And I will say that when Southeast Asia was exploring transitions, there were not many people who were fully supportive of it, because it was seen as greenwashing in the global community, or seen as an avenue for people to greenwash easily. But I think now it's become reality that we need to be able to transition, and we need to have that pathway. The third pillar is actually disclosures. And until recently, we had a whole alphabet soup of disclosure platforms, but the formation of the International Sustainability Standard Board has actually rolled up many of those alphabet soups and created a very streamlined approach to sustainability disclosure for the capital markets. So now we have two major standard setters, the ISSB and the Global Reporting Initiative, who actually set standards for impact reporting. So if you like to look at it in very technical sense, ISSB is a single materiality framework, and GRI is a double materiality framework. I happen to think they're both very complementary and actually work very well hand in hand to address the entire stakeholder community needs. So those are the three pillars that we are trying to concentrate on in Southeast Asia. But of course, you know, developing the pillars, developing the ecosystem, it's like decorating a dance hall. If you don't get people to come and dance, it's not very useful. So we find that it is extremely critical that as we develop the pillars, we also develop the lever to push sustainable finance. And that lever is actually a mutually reinforcing demand and supply for sustainable finance. So these are the things that we're trying to work on. And I will say that the policymakers and regulators in the financial sector in the region have been very steadfast. They haven't changed their direction. They've just really intensified efforts along these three pillars, and it's actually worked quite well. Maybe, Joseph, I can also share a bit about what these efforts have resulted in.
Yes, please. Yes, please.
Well, so before the three reports I talked about just now were created, the Southeast Asian capital market regulators came together and said, let's try and do something to create a common definition, right? At that time, they couldn't create a common classification framework, which is a taxonomy, but they said, let's first start with a common definition. And I was also involved in that process. And this common definition would be used for the issuance of bonds. So in 2017, the capital markets regulators worked together with the ICMA, the International Capital Market Association. And using the ICMA's green bond principles and social bond principles and sustainability guidelines, actually worked on a parallel set of guidances. So the result was the issuance of the ASEAN Green Bond Standards in 2017. At the end of 2017, actually, the ASEAN Social Bond Standards and the ASEAN Sustainability Bond Standards in 2018. The unusual part about this was that the ASEAN standards specifically prohibited the financing of fossil fuels.
Mm.
And there were many people who were very concerned about this, saying that if you cut fossil fuels out, no one's going to use it. But today, over $42 billion of bonds have been issued under that label. So I'm just under those three labels. So I'm saying label. There are also bonds that have been issued using those standards, but they are not labeled under those standards. So they're just aligned to the standards. But just as a minimum, you can see through the labeled products, we have $42 billion. So that started to show what we can do by coming together, creating transparency, providing clarity. It builds an asset class. It enables the flow of capital into a particular criteria of investments. So from there, of course, the regulators were very encouraged, and then they moved on and they produced the three documents I spoke of just now. Following that, we had a couple of very interesting developments. Firstly, was the establishment of the ASEAN Taxonomy Board. And that is an effort that is, I would say, overseen by finance ministers and central bank governors of Southeast Asia collectively. It comprises the central banks, capital market regulators, insurance regulators, and ministries of finance. So it is a very, very, you can see, comprehensive effort by everybody to create this common language. At the ASEAN capital markets forums levels, it has actually produced a standard for responsible, for sustainable and responsible funds, so that helps avoid greenwashing. It has, again, on the back of the ICMA equivalent, produced a standard for sustainability-linked bonds. And very recently, on the 17th of October, it launched the ASEAN Transition Finance Guidance. That, I think, is an extremely pivotal event, because we have a lot of transition guidances out there today. They're all very good, but they're not geographically or regionally or entity specific. So as a result, the guidances can be quite broad and they apply to a very broad audience. But again, Southeast Asia needs a very different sort of transition. And we need to be able to empower that transition. So the ASEAN Transition Finance Guidance actually does that. It is the coming together of all the capital market regulators together with input from other stakeholders like the actual businesses themselves and the financial sector. So that, again, I think is a very landmark effort by the capital market regulators.
That's a lot to download, and I think we could speak about any of those areas for quite a few hours. But going back to what you were talking about, that you've got all of these different entities coming together, how would you define the cooperation and collaboration among the regulators in ASEAN in general, and also between, you know, the regulators with the corporations with the financial institutions, et cetera? I mean, this is an ecosystem that, and the way I want to kind of paraphrase it is to try to get, you know, you're having a party, you've got 20 people over your house, if your house is big enough. In Hong Kong, obviously, that would not be the case. But you've got 20 people coming over, and you expect them to drink and eat exactly the same thing in exactly the same amount, which is virtually impossible, right? So that's really what this kind of cooperation, collaboration between regulators, corporations, and financial institutions is trying to achieve, which is in itself extremely challenging. So based on that, how do you see the kind of evolution of this cooperation, collaboration amongst regulators in ASEAN? And also, and then second part is, how do you see that working with corporations, financial institutions, and regulators?
Well, let me answer that question in the airline survey way. So I will first give you my overall assessment of the level of cooperation. And I would say it is fantastic.
Mm.
Why do I say that? We have, as you mentioned just now, 10 different countries. And if you just look at the main financial regulators in each country, you have the central bank, you have the capital market regulator, you've got the insurance regulator, you've got the Ministry of Finance. So essentially, you can say there are 40 key regulators for the financial sector in Southeast Asia. Now, when we started meeting...
Sorry, Eugene, so it's 40 people at the table, not 20.
Yeah, so it's essentially, yeah, we've got to have much bigger house than the Hong Kong apartment. So when we started talking about the ASEAN taxonomy and how we should put it together, conversations started with the capital market regulators probably in October. And it started with them because obviously, you know, they'd done the ASEAN Green Bond Standard, so they're a bit more familiar with trying to bring this concept together. They quite quickly were able to agree on what direction that should take. And then when we started speaking to the central banks, of course, because they had their own blueprint already, were quite prepared to do this. But then they brought in the other regulators into the discussion. I have to say, I was very impressed with the conversations, because as we had different groups coming together, the conversations were firstly very well informed, very objective, and importantly, very collegial. Because I think the regulators didn't concentrate on their differences. They concentrated on the commonalities. And there was a lot of trust and open conversations. It was a good thing that everyone had a position of their own already from a sectoral perspective, and they were able to meld that position in a very short time. So we started talking about this in October. We essentially had agreement by, I think it was late January, that we would bring it to the meeting of the finance ministers and central bank governors. And when we brought it to them, they endorsed it on the very day. So the taxonomy board was actually formed on the 31st of March, 2021, the day after the central bank, the finance ministers and central bank governors endorsed the effort and decided this is going to be our common language. I'm not sure where else in the world you can find 40 different parties coming together, representing 10 countries, agreeing in such a short time to work together. So that was the first test, right? So, I mean, there were skeptics who were saying, yeah, they just agreed to come together. They can't produce anything because they'll just argue all the way through. But by COP27 in November 2021, by COP26, actually, I should say, November 2021, the first version of the ASEAN taxonomy had been produced. So that was really testament to the cooperation amongst the regulators. And I will say, we are the host, so I have the full insight perspective of this. I will say the regulators contributed so much to the development effort. They brought industry in. They consulted other parts of government. They literally drove this thing themselves with their own resources. So I would say the cooperation has been fantastic at the regional level. The ASEAN Transition Finance Guidance, transition is a really touchy subject, right? But the ASEAN Transition Finance Guidance, again, was put out by the 10 capital market regulators. So they came together to agree through their own intelligence, the information they had, the research they did. They came together to agree on a pathway that would help chart transition for the capital markets in Southeast Asia. So I think it's been fantastic. And it's very collaborative, both at the national and regional levels. In terms of corporations, financial institutions, I mean, these are the key stakeholders. So if you remember, I did mention that one of the key pillars for one of the key lever for us is actually for the demand and supply of sustainable finance to be reinforced and to be mutually reinforcing. So because of that, the capital market regulators actually have formed an official industry advisory panel that gives them feedback on ideas that they have, that actually gives them proactive feedback on where the market needs that support. That's been going on very well. We actually convened the industry advisory panel for them at the ASEAN level, the ASEAN Taxonomy Board. Massive stakeholder consultations are always held. So when version one was released, the ASEAN Taxonomy Board held a massive consultation. Now that we've released version two of the taxonomy, again, there's a massive consultation. We take the feedback of everybody seriously. And I think it's a very open approach because we also have stakeholders, corporations and FIs approach us directly to say that we've got some views or we've got some needs. Can you help us out? So it's been a very positive relationship. The capital market regulators in particular have signaled to me that they actually want more interactions. So that is something they're planning to do next year. It's very encouraging in the sense that they're not living in an ivory tower, but they're opening up to work with stakeholders for a common goal.
That's great. And I do hope that listeners appreciate the incredible amount of work that this involves. I mean, on the one hand, you've got trying to get dozens of parties to, you know, agree on at least a few parameters, and on the other hand, you know, you've got to do the research to back it up. You've got, you know, your ASEAN Transition Finance guidance sounds like, you know, something easy to put together, but I'm sure it was very, very difficult. So I think appreciating the amount of work that has gone into it is absolutely amazing, and it's important to understand that. When it comes to, so we've talked a lot about what is going on right now, but I feel personally, I don't know if you agree, Eugene, that education in general, I mean, educating people about energy, the energy transition, climate finance in general, is very important because it is something relatively new. Actually, what I love is people have come out and have been at it for like 2 or 3 years and say, "Well, I'm a global expert on this." And I want to talk about education. I don't mean education just from maybe high school to university level, but also the education that needs to take place with the regulators, because it is an area that I'm not familiar with corporations, because corporations are there to make money and focus on, you know, profitability, and all of a sudden they're burdened with a massive amount of new KPIs and also regulations that they have to follow. And then you've got the financial institutions that basically really have to change how they think about life in an easy way, in a simple way of putting it. So how are the capacity building efforts going? I mean, are we ahead of, say, for example, the EU or US, or are we behind the EU and the US in ASEAN?
So I'm glad you asked that question because it also gives me the opportunity to talk about the gaps that we need the ecosystem to fix. So right at the top of the list of gaps is actually the demand and supply gap for capital. The second I would say is what you've just mentioned, which is awareness and education. The third is on risks and rewards. The fourth is on coordination amongst the different stakeholders. The fifth is actually our market versus policy. So these are some of the key gaps that we need the ecosystem to fix. And without capacity building, even we can't fix the other gaps. So education is absolutely important. I think there'll be a lot of good efforts, but we need to move a bit faster. Mm. I also agree with you that it's actually quite dangerous that we have a whole bunch of people coming out claiming to be sustainable finance experts when they've been at it for maybe a year, 2 years, 3 years. I've worked very closely with the different stakeholders on this particular subject. Certainly for 3 years, it's been a very intense journey for us at the Sustainable Finance Institute Asia. But I've also had a history of sustainable finance even prior to this. And I will say, Joseph, I struggle every day with the developments, with the change in circumstances. So I think, you know, it is very hard these days to hold yourself out as a supreme expert because you continuously have to educate yourself and improve yourself. There are two levels actually to this. So the first is actually the awareness building. And I think I mentioned just now the gap awareness building education. The awareness actually is short. It's short because we need the whole spectrum of stakeholders to understand the implications of this and the interrelationships. And so it's not just about educating, say, the regulators, corporates, and financial institutions. You've got to educate the rest of the ecosystem. So it's everybody from the lawyers, for example, judges, engineers, people in real economy situations where, you know, if I'm running a company, I actually have to understand why what I'm going to do is going to have an impact and what I need to do to reduce that impact or to improve that impact. And essentially, that leads to the need for financing because we've got to change either the operations or the technology model that I'm using. Mm-hmm. So we need to educate everyone along that spectrum. Now, are we doing a very good job in this part of the world? I think we're accelerating very fast. Mm-hmm. But we're also, in terms of economic development, we're also perhaps not, not comparable to, say, the EU. So it is understandable, but on a relative scale, I think we're doing well. But we need much, much more. In fact, the world needs much, much more. So we also have to start investing in the young because these are the people who are going to come out and we are talking about the journey. So they need to start shaping the journey. One of the things we've done at Sophia is to actually interact with students from institutions. We've experimented with this in Singapore. The results have been very positive. We work with institutions of higher learning. They've consistently asked us to come back and do more with their students. Today, we've interacted with over 1,800 students, and that's created an awareness in them as they got to the workforce. And it's great because we have these young students also coming up, not just being aware themselves, but creating awareness amongst the more senior people, mid-level people, as they enter the workforce. So one major area of development is actually in the approach to sustainable finance itself. So it's building a body of knowledge base. So we work actually very closely with the Asian Development Bank, who's been helping capacity for regulators, policymakers, as well as industry. In fact, the Asian Development Bank even helps corporates in Southeast Asia develop their issuance strategy for sustainable bonds. So this is something that we need to continue, because capacity building in education is not about just bringing a bunch of people into a room and giving them a lecture. It's about teaching them how to do. And it's not also about doing it for them, because, you know, that old adage, if you give someone a fish, he eats for a day, you teach him how to fish, he's going to be happy for his whole lifetime. So that sort of capacity building, real action learning, is really important. One key development we will see in Southeast Asia that's been announced is that the International Sustainability Standards Board and the Global Reporting Initiative have come together to establish a Sustainability Innovation Lab in Singapore, which will be headquartered in Singapore. And GRI is the founding partner, with ISSB being the convening partner. And this lab is actually meant to address the capacity shortfalls that we have. One interesting aspect of this lab is its focus on SMEs, because, you know, MSMEs are the backbone of Southeast Asia. We have 70 million MSMEs in Southeast Asia. We've got to start educating them. So this lab will actually start to build capacity in disclosures. And I think by building that capacity in disclosures, people get to see where they are, they start to compare, they start to develop strategies, how they can improve moving forward.
So it's, and by the way, it's something that I take to heart, because I try to do my very, very tiny bit contribution, which is, you know, through these podcasts, through a book I published and a book that I'm going to publish hopefully next year, and also through some op-eds. So I think, you know, at the end of the day, if everybody that has got a little bit of experience in the sector can contribute, and like you say, you know, it's not so much just giving a lecture and then saying, okay, well, I've ticked the box, now I can walk away. It's about helping the people who are going to be the practitioners to with their practice, you know, because practice makes perfect, right? So I think it's very important. So I just wanted to kind of wrap up our fantastic, incredible conversation today with the hardest question of the day, which is, from your own personal perspective, given your experience, given what you witnessed and what you're witnessing now, how do you see things evolving over the next two and a half decades or so? You know, where do you see some of the actions that need to be undertaken to accelerate the development of regulation and development of taxonomies and the development of green finance in general?
Right. Well, that's an excellent question. Let me gaze in my crystal ball and answer that. I think we will have to really work at continuing to strengthen the ecosystem, because that's what's going to drive everything. And in the immediate future, transition is going to be our biggest challenge. I think for us, the battle for the climate will actually be based on how we manage transition. So transition, unfortunately, continues to be a very difficult topic, because unlike financing something green, which you already understand very clearly what the impact is going to be, transition is very forward-looking, and it entails you evaluating a journey. But it is also where that change is going to come from and where it's needed. So we will, in the immediate future, have to focus on transition. I'm, of course, very keen to go to COP28 to see what the position on fossil fuels is going to be. Is it going to be a phase-out of unabated fossil fuels? Is it going to be a phase-down of fossil fuels? Is it going to be a phase-out of fossil fuels? I think that direction is very important, because it will also set the ambition for many people and orientation of capital. Greenwashing is the other thing we have to watch out for. And indeed, I think if we start to impose a lot of rules, we also must provide the clarity. Otherwise, there will be people who start greenwashing for two reasons. The first is they can't meet the requirements, but they want the capital. So they will start to create some fiction around what they can do and what they are going to do. The other is actually people who are just generally going to be so frightened that they can't meet the expectations that they start to hide away. So that's called green hushing or green blushing, as you may have heard the term. So I think it's very clear that we enhance the whole clarity on disclosures and the obligations around disclosures.
So on greenwashing, I can just add, and I don't know if you agree with this point, Eugene, but there's also another category of corporations, which is individuals that don't really have a full understanding of what it is that they're supposed to be talking about. And then they make errors in judgment in terms of expressing it. So they're not actually greenwashing per se, but they just, don't fully understand the subject. So they think they're doing something green, but actually they're not.
You're absolutely right. And I think there's been this big debate about how you should be punishing people for greenwashing, right? So you have people who intentionally mislead. You have people who, I won't say innocently, but through their lack of knowledge, mislead. And of course, if you're a director, you start to get very worried about making statements. For example, if a statement refers to the future, you might be quite worried about whether or not that statement would actually turn out to be true. And it may be better not to say anything. But not saying anything is greenwashing, and it's a form of greenwashing. So this is where I think your point about education is very important. And indeed, I talked about the GRI, ISSB, Sustainability Innovation Lab initiative. That is actually very important in helping educate people and build capacity so that they are able to make the right disclosures, able to make informed decisions on what they're doing and what they're saying. So yes, I think that's extremely important. There's been a lot of action, as you know, not just by capital market supervisors, but also by agencies and regulatory bodies looking after consumer behavior, like competition commissions, fair trade regulators. They're actually also looking at this and starting to take action on it as well. So, I mean, what we want is really for disclosures to be able to guide the orientation of capital. We don't want people to be so frightened that they don't make any disclosures or the liabilities to be disproportionate. But we do have to educate them. We do have to give them a reason not to make mistakes. Yeah, so I think that's going to be something that's important. There's also the real question of how we get the funds flowing. And we talk a lot about how there's trillions and trillions of dollars of capital available for sustainable finance, but we don't always see it. It's not flowing into where we hope it's flowing at the rate we want it to flow. So we need to really deal with this bottleneck. So firstly, commitments are very important, particularly from countries who are able to provide the capital. De-risking is an important element to this, particularly currency de-risking. I think that currency is an extremely important element for emerging markets. So can you imagine if you're say in Vietnam and you want to do an affordable housing project and it's financed in US dollar, who's going to take it up? Because if the dong moves from the US dollar, these guys who are already in need of affordable housing have to take the foreign exchange risk. So we need to really put some money into this, and blended finance can definitely help in this respect. We are not focusing enough on adaptation. I would say we're like in a boat with a hole and water's filling up. So if you try and patch the hole, it's mitigation. We're all trying to do that. But in the meantime, the water's filling up. So aren't you going to empty the water, which is adaptation? So we need to be able to do that as well. I will say that current conditions are not very favorable. We have an environment of high interest rates. High interest rates also affect emerging market countries because where there's an interest rate differential, their currencies will drop. We have greenflation coming in. We have supply chain bottlenecks. We have geopolitical situations we have to watch out for. So we are in dire need of a transformation. There are many obstacles ahead of us, and I think we really have to double down on this and work harder on it. So again, Joseph, I think what you're doing is indeed very admirable. We need everyone out there to try and get this message across to as many people as they can. And of course, as you also said, in the right way.
Right. Well, listen, Eugene, this has been an absolute fantastic conversation, and I appreciate your time. I know you've got an extremely busy schedule in between trips, and on top of it, I'm sure you're very, very tired from all the travels and stuff. So I really appreciate the insights. I think it's a really, really key conversation to talk about, you know, everything from the regulator's kind of angle and understanding what it is that in all the efforts that have been put in, which people see the result of the work, but they don't see all of the work that goes into the conclusions and the reports, which is actually quite admirable. So once again, Eugene, I want to really, really thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me, Joseph.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Asia Climate Finance Podcast. Please note that the Asia Climate Finance Podcast is presented for educational purposes only. All information in the podcast must not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed by our guests are personal and may not represent those of current or previous employers.